are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 24th. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a pre-recorded but brand new for you interview that Sam did with NYU professor Jonathan Morduch on the Financial Diaries, real life experiences of Americans dealing with inequality and the economic crisis. Donald Trump's 62% of Americans say that he is dividing the country. Can't believe that's not higher. Gun control, gun sales declining as fears of the government taking your guns away decline. Of course, gun sales skyrocketed under Obama, and he didn't do anything to take away your guns either. Just let you carry them in public parks, which is part of the reason that we're dealing with these crazy alt-right people in open carry situations. Angela Merkel speaking out against isolationism in the United States under Trump, even as she continues to govern Germany in a center-right way. Welcome to the resistance. Emmanuel Macron's poll numbers plummeting even faster than I had predicted. I thought we would be at this level of plummet maybe six months from now.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu. Make the third way mediocrity corporatism great again. Trump bashed Jeff Flake in Arizona, and Jeff Flake being the C-K that he is, thanked him for it. Brian Kilmeade not happy about a new faculty appointment at Howard University. Newt Gingrich somehow managing to connect a Civil War reference and an insane comparison between the Confederates and the left, which he is known for, with a brand new right-wing ballywick, or not a brand new one, but a new consistent right-wing ballywick, whining about ESPN. Apparently, ESPN anchors acknowledging that racism exists is one of the reasons that we're about to have a socialist revolution in this country. And Tucker Carlson and Mark Stein joined together as a super team to show everybody how to not deliver a joke. All that and more on today's Majority Report. And, of course, your calls and IMs in the second half. I'm at the helm for the second half. We're going to get to the interview that Sam did with Jonathan Morduch in a minute. But first, it's a pretty delicious piece of sound from Sean Hannity. I like the desperation level that we're at right now. Out of the gate, Donald Trump built his political brand on dropping racial subtext and just embracing the white identity politics, which is the heart of normal voters in the Republican Party. There's the top end of the Republican Party, the donors, the funders, the handful of plutocrats that just want to destroy the modern infrastructure of government and have resources redistributed to them upwards, and that's their entire sense of how government works. Adelson, Cokes, those guys. And then the only way they leverage normal people that aren't vastly wealthy to go vote for them is through various forms of white identity triggers. And, of course, Trump just went to the heart of it, and he was a master of it, and that's why I always thought he'd win the Republican nomination. But it is a delicate game, and a lot of Republicans in media and otherwise would still like some plausible deniability. But Trump makes it pretty hard to do plausible deniability with the whole, there were nice people in the khaki Nazi rally. And so here is Sean Hannity, not exactly known for being all that quick on his feet, calling out the fake news for accusing Donald Trump of being racist. And Sean Hannity has gone deep into Donald Trump's history in a sort of analytic rigor, which we have not seen in this debate before, to demonstrate that not only is Donald Trump not a racist, he has a history of quite literally not being a racist. And Sean Hannity is a pretty brilliant way of explaining how.
Now, try and put yourself in the position of the president. If you were unfairly lied about, if you were called a racist, one of the worst things you can say about somebody, you know you're not. You have a history of not being racist. You've spoken out against racism your whole life. Wouldn't you feel a need to defend yourself, your honor, your reputation, your character, your family? Well, the Destroy Trump media, they are beyond pathetic, and they deserve now every bit of criticism that they're getting from the president and rational thinking Americans.
So I will do the basic rundown here, even though it's totally useless. Going back to the 70s, the Trump Organization was sued by the federal government for housing discrimination against black people. Donald Trump took out a page in the, I believe in the New York Times, calling for a reinstatement of the death penalty in the Central Park 5 case. That was a case where immediately when these teenagers were arrested for that crime, Trump was out front and center calling for the death penalty. They've all since been exonerated. He's not apologized or retracted his position in the slightest, even as they have been exonerated in every possible way and even had restitution paid to them by the city of New York. Under de Blasio, I should add. Bloomberg did not pay them out. And he also, the series of stupid comments like, it's a big advantage to be an educated black, and I want guys in yarmulkes handling my money. And the reports of people on The Apprentice saying that he said bizarre racial things all the time. And then, of course, being the father, the mainstreamer of birtherism and building a whole national political profile on xenophobia and racism and conspiracy theory thinking about Barack Obama. Now, that, I will say, Sean Hannity has a compelling answer to that, which is that Donald Trump has had a long history of totally, like, not being a racist and such. These people are such airheads. It's amazing. And now, even in the context, I guess when Trump is defending himself from not being racist, he still finds a pretty good amount of time to defend Nazis and monuments dedicated to people who fought a war to stop the founding of modern America so that they can continue torturing and profiting off of the free labor of enslaved black people. But besides that, he's totally not a racist.
But nobody calls Sean Hannity.
Exactly. Nobody calls Sean Hannity. Hey, thank you, everybody. The Michael Brooks Show is doing great. We're at, I think now, 569 patrons. A lot of people are watching the YouTube show. We have 87 reviews on iTunes. Please keep spreading the word. In the last show, if you haven't seen it yet, I had a Noah Changa and Sam Saxon did a detailed look at civilian casualties in Afghanistan, played the best political ad of modern times, which is put out by Momentum in the UK, talked about the dum-dum left, the pseudo-woke center. Sam Sachs and I did a Mike Cernovich impression contest. But just to let everybody know, tomorrow we're doing the show live on Friday at 6 p.m. Usually we're Tuesday at 7 p.m., but since we're on vacation next week, we're going to be streaming live at 6 p.m. Of course, patrons get the post-game, and also next week patrons are going to get an exclusive interview I did with Steve Cook on the lobbying inside Washington, D.C. around the Gulf crisis. So thank you, everybody. I appreciate it immensely. We'll be here live tomorrow at 6. I'm going to be hosting tomorrow on the Majority Report. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Sam's interview with Jonathan Murdoch on the Financial Diaries.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jonathan Murdoch. He is a professor of public policy and economics at the NYU Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. He is also the co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty, and he co-authored that with Rachel Schneider, who is a senior vice president at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you, Sam.
So, all right. So, describe to us the book is based on these financial diaries. Describe to us first why, and we should just say it's 235 households. It's conducted in five states across the country: Ohio, Kentucky, California, Mississippi, and New York. Why did you do this? What question did you have, I guess, that you were hoping this would at least provide some answers to?
Yeah, I mean, the question, why did we do this, was something that we kept asking ourselves at various points during the project. But the reason we started was that there's tons of data about the condition of American families, right? There's lots of government reports, there are a lot of foundation reports, and so it's a big question: who needs more data on how people have ended up? But we felt, Rachel and I and a group of funders, that there wasn't really data on how families were living week by week, how they were making decisions, what obstacles they were running into. We had a lot of snapshots, but we didn't have anything that was rigorous and focused on households' economic and financial lives, but was something more like a movie. Something more capturing how households are moving through time. And so we created these financial diaries, which were really day-to-day kind of records of everything that these 235 households were doing, really every financial transaction, everything they earned or spent or borrowed, everything. And that turned out to be a truly unique window on their lives.
Okay, so this was over the course of 2012, 2013, but and I want to get to sort of what the implications of that time period might be in terms of the data, and then we'll go through the different sort of elements that you of their financial lives that you uncovered. But just from a mechanical standpoint, so like, what did the diary look like? Were the instructions that they got, were any time a dollar comes in or goes out, or what, or did you have like a series of questions that they should fill out every day? How did that work?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because, you know, in truth, it's a bit of a misnomer. So we think of these as diaries in the sense that they're intimate, they're daily, they try to capture everything. They reveal things which are often hidden that you don't share with others. But mechanically, the way that we did it is we had full-time researchers, part of a team on site in every location, who would visit the households every 2 to 4 weeks and run through, you know, day by day everything the households were doing. So in practice, households often ended up keeping their own records. But mechanically, we ended up going to the households and writing it down in a kind of format, entering it into our database, doing corrections, and then later coming back and, you know, asking them when things didn't quite look like they were adding up. So it, in many ways, it was like a traditional survey, but it was just happening at an incredibly high frequency every couple of weeks.
And why did you, I mean, just out of curiosity, why that? I mean, I imagine you sort of weighed different methodologies. Why that one?
So why not just actually do diaries?
Yeah.
Tradition? Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think we wanted to make sure there was quality control. And it's exactly like you were saying, right? Like making sure that the right answers were asked and the right responses were filled in. You know, when you do this, you've got households who are incredibly busy.
Right.
You know, it's really incredible that 235 households agreed to open up their lives to us like this. And so just having them focus for that time with the field researcher present was really, really valuable. Otherwise, it's like, you know, filling out your taxes. You just don't want to do it. And, we had lots of households who said in the end, like, this was really a pain. It was really tedious, but I'm glad I did it in the end. And I hope people through this process can see what I'm going through. But, you know, voluntarily, they wouldn't have done it.
Well, you did start out with like 400 families, right? And then a significant number sort of dropped out, I guess, through the process. How did you choose the families?
Yeah, we started off with these 400 families, and we started off with this big intake survey, this like monster survey to like get a baseline. And once a big chunk of families saw what we were up to, they said, forget it, good luck to you, we're not interested, which was good for them and good for us because we needed to have households who would stick with it. What we were looking for was households that were typical of the condition of working families today. So everybody had to have a working member, at least one working member. Some households were on average below the poverty line, about a quarter below the poverty line. About a quarter were around the median in their areas, around the middle. So nobody was really rich and no one was incredibly poor. Most were kind of in the middle class, lower income, close to the poverty line or below. Kind of looking for households who get lost often in conversations. So like when we talk about inequality, we're often so focused on the top 10% or the top 1% of the income distribution. We wanted to spend time with households that were in the bottom 50% of the distribution, but not the very, very poor.
And were they also, you say income, but also wealth distribution? I mean, I guess, you know, once you get below 25% or so, things probably flatten out a little bit in terms of wealth because people across the income spectrum are not saving as much. But what did wealth play in this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, these are households largely, many of whom have a lot of debt of various kinds, consumer debt, student debt, housing debt. So their wealth situation, you know, they're the part of America who don't have much wealth relative to what's happening at the top end. So we wanted to understand how these households are coping in situations where their income has been fairly stagnant, their wealth is not growing, and they're dealing with debt. And then, you know, the big story that we saw, the big revelation was by spending time with the household through the year, we started to see a lot of volatility and unpredictability. And that kind of helped us see a new picture of how these households were doing.
Well, that is I think the thing that really stands out in the first, I guess the first three chapters are earning and saving and smoothing and spiking. And it's the earning is one thing, but the spending is also fascinating. But walk us through like, you know, what it is, what did you find out between, you know, within that dynamic of both earning and spending? There's a similar dynamic, I guess, which is at play, which is, of course, that volatility. But tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, before jumping into our story, I just saw a statistic that was collected, I think, by the Pew Charitable Trust. So this was a nationally representative survey. So thousands of households, you know, versus our 235 households. And I think the question was, can you predict your income and expenses relatively consistently month by month? And just 47% of Americans said that they could. I think I'm getting that right. So about half of households said they had relatively consistent earning and spending month by month. It means the other half didn't. And that's really what we were seeing. So, for example, I spent some time in Mississippi, one of our sites, and I got to know a card dealer named Janice. She deals cards at a casino in eastern Mississippi, and her earnings are largely based on tips. So this is one example of how this happens. So it turns out for Janice that in the summer, her paychecks are big. People are in the casino, they're gambling, you know, everything's very busy, she's doing well. But fall comes around, kids go back to school, football's on TV, and all of a sudden the casino starts to clear out because she's earning tips. Her paychecks start falling pretty sharply. By Christmas time, her paychecks are way down. And those kinds of patterns, whether it's people earning, you know, money on tips or commission or hourly work, which is not steady and guaranteed, that became a big story in our data and really changed the way people are saving and borrowing. So to give you one data point from our observations, if we look at households' income month by month, and we think about the average of that income, we counted 5 months of the year where the households were either 25% above the average or 25% below their average. So 5 months out of the year. When we talk about income swings and unpredictability, that was really striking. Because when your income's going up and down like that, it's hard to budget, it's hard to save. We have lots of advice for households that they should, you know, be slow and steady and prudent. But when your income's going up and down like that, it's really, really hard. And then, like you said, it's spending needs also that are bouncing around too.
Well, I want to get to spending in a second, but I want to get to, you know, what you observed were the causes for that. I mean, it was interesting because I'm watching the show Ozarks, just this line came up about, you know, July 4th weekend was, they called it, I think, a ruler. If it ruled the rest of the year. If you did okay on July 4th that weekend, then you'll have enough for the rest of the year. And it made me think of Janice. She's referred to as Janice Evans in the book. I don't think that's her real name, was it just like a function of people are in businesses that are like are seasonal, or is it that there are other factors that impact the earning volatility?
Yeah, you know, it's not just seasonality. For some, you know, the seasons matter. Janice is a great story because of that. But often it's just businesses are having ups and downs in demand. You know, folks are going to the mall, folks are going to the restaurant, or not. And what we're seeing is a fundamental shift in the labor market. That's the deeper story. It's really been happening since the 80s. It's often called, you know, a hollowing out of the labor market. So those sort of solid middle-class jobs that used to, you know, earn between, you know, pay between maybe $25,000 a year and $50,000 a year, they're a lot harder to find. Those jobs in manufacturing and administrative jobs, clerical jobs, used to be pretty steady, often unionized. And so what we're seeing is households earning money in different ways. They may be in construction, they may be in services and retail. And often those jobs are much less stable, much less predictable. Hours are bouncing up and down. You're counting on, you know, overtime. You're not, you know, you might not get that overtime. It turns out that a lot of folks have steady jobs, but not steady paychecks.
So 1 week they're getting 40 hours, and next week we only have 25 hours for you this week. That type of situation.
Yeah, exactly. Show up at the restaurant prepared to do your shift, and you're told to go home because there aren't enough customers there. And that's on you. That's not on the restaurant. That's the shift.
And that's a reflection of a broader change to going to more of like a service economy, right, than a manufacturing economy?
Yeah. It's a lot of things going on at the same time. It's really a shift in power. Power from workers to employers, because they can do this, and workers are pretty powerless. So it's partly a shift in the kind of job, but also in the relationship between the workers and the bosses. And so it's all playing out, and technology is also exacerbating some of it. You know, these algorithms that you know, headquarters of a restaurant are running these algorithms, and the managers are beholden to them and have to send the workers home when, you know, headquarters says, hey, we don't need that many people, you know, at work today, so send them home.
So I think people are probably, you know, more intuitively aware of maybe the earning volatility, but the spending volatility is something that I guess people don't contemplate as, because, you know, it so much of it, I think, appears to be sort of chance that you don't necessarily see the patterns that you saw.
Yeah, and the two really go together. Because usually, you know, spending volatility, and here we're talking about, you know, unpredictable things. Could be a health problem. It could be your car breaks down. Could be your roof needs fixing. A whole series of things that just come up as part of life. right? Your paycheck isn't, I'm sorry, your spending isn't necessarily the same month to month. And usually it wouldn't be such a big deal. But when your paychecks are going up and down at the same time, you can really get trapped when you have a low paycheck plus your car just broke down. And then we start to see households in a very different situation than they used to be.
And what happens in those situations? I mean, so if you do have a situation where, like, okay, I only got 20 hours 2 weeks out of this month, as opposed to the 40 hours that I anticipated, and my car breaks down, that then creates a potential for another spiral, right? Because of what you've got to do to make up that difference.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve just released a study earlier this year. This is, again, national data. It's not our data. It's Federal Reserve data. And they asked a sample of Americans whether they could come up with $400 in an emergency, something just like you're describing. You know, you need something to fix the car, $400. And only, 44% of Americans said they could not come up with $400 without putting it on a credit card and paying it off over time or without selling something. So the responses are often those kinds of things. You have to borrow. Could be from a friend or relative. That's often, a tactic if that's, possible. But often it's, putting money on your credit card. And that has repercussions down the road.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about those repercussions, because I would imagine, like, in some instances, you're going to, a payday lender. But, some credit cards, I would also imagine that if you have that type of volatility, you're looking at pretty excessive interest rates for someone who may have had, if you're going through that type of volatility, I would imagine your chances of having, credit dings have impacted you. So you're eligible for cards that have a higher interest rate. And then all of a sudden you have that, you're paying this off at an increasing interest rate. That's going to increase your sensitivity to any swings in your paycheck or in your expenditures.
Yeah, that's right. So you're already down, and then this is just spiraling. Sometimes, you'll have a spike. One of the things with volatility is you have downs and then you have ups. And so sometimes you can catch up, down the road when things are really busy. It's like that July 4th weekend you're just talking about with Ozarks. It allows you to catch up and, you can get back on track. But sometimes that doesn't happen so easily. You mentioned payday lending. It turns out that wasn't a big deal in what we saw, nor is it a huge deal or as big a deal as you'd think in the national data. Some households really do rely on payday lending a lot, but mostly households that we saw are, using their credit cards and turning to family and friends. They'll do that well before, turning to payday lenders.
When we talk about how people cope, I mean, and maybe the data is not necessarily broad enough to make these, sort of blanket statements, but in the context of your data, anecdotally, I guess, is there a difference between the ability of certain demographics to rely on one coping mechanism versus another? Because, I mean, just from different people we've spoken to on this program, I know that broadly speaking, wealth amongst African Americans there's just less wealth that has developed in the African American community. I mean, largely because of housing issues and whatnot. But in that instance, your ability to have a network where you could borrow, let's say, at no interest or very low interest, is hampered. Did you see any of that or any dynamics like that?
I think the big point is absolutely right. We did not see a huge difference across, Hispanics or Blacks or others. What we saw is a general fact that if you are poorer and you have fewer resources, one, you're going to tend to have less of a cushion yourself. You're probably going to be more vulnerable to these ups and downs, so you're in a tougher spot. Plus, all the people around you, your relatives and your community, are in a similar situation. And so you're going to have fewer resources to draw on as well. You'll maximize them all. And so everyone's bound up in the same situation. But it's a general situation that, you know, richer people are better off for lots of reasons. But one of them is jobs that pay more are usually more steady. And you've got more resources to draw on in various ways, your community, your friends, your family, when you really need it.
And what of the sort of dispositional? I mean, one of the, you know, like the idea that some people are savers and some people are not. I mean, did that have, you know, if there was a way for you to measure, right, like dispositionally, I'm responsible with money. I don't know. Did that have an impact? How much did that mean in light of the volatility of expenses and income?
Yeah, you know, some people are much better savers than others. That's just a fact. But we saw something that really changed the way we thought about savings. So Janice, for example, Janice Evans, the card dealer, she saves like crazy because she knows that, you know, winter is going to be tough and Christmas time is going to be tough. And so in the summer, she really, really works hard to put money aside. So she opened up an account at a credit union about an hour south of her, and she snipped up the ATM card so she's less tempted to withdraw money from there, and she kept a steady flow going in. So she was a really dedicated saver, and she also knew herself and her temptation, so she, you know, created a wall or created a barrier. This credit union also like had lousy hours, and she's like, that's fine for me, because she knew that that barrier was helpful at some level, but if she really needed the money, she'd go down and get it out. But the story that we saw with Janice and so many others was that she worked really hard to save, so she wasn't just profligate, recklessly overspending, but that money was earmarked and was spent within the year to deal with the short-term ups and downs, as it had to be. She did not have a big retirement account. She had some from the casino, but she was basically ill-prepared for what was coming down the road in the future. But that's the way in which we saw sort of a different take on the savings story. When we saw people who didn't have long-term savings, it didn't mean that they were recklessly overspending. What it often meant was they're actually saving, but for short-term needs, and they weren't really getting help with this. And government policies and plans often are actually making it harder to do that. And so change the story in a fundamental way.
So in other words, they just simply didn't have the resources to save long-term, that their savings had to be short and mid-term. Their savings horizon was shorter, I guess. And what policies inhibit their ability to save?
Well, often for poorer families, there are asset limits on, you know, your ability to build up savings in savings accounts. And, you know, for the big welfare programs or housing programs often, you just aren't allowed to build up assets. Even though evidence shows that the households that are able to build up a savings account will do better and will get off of government support more easily. But
so,
we often have porous policies that are working against helping households save.
So in other words, if you go through a period where you need to get on food stamps, let's say, or you need some other form of assistance, the fact that you've saved cuts against your ability to get that immediate help. You'll have to drain down your savings so that the next time you run into that situation, you're eligible.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Now, food stamps, they've, you know, been lifting the asset limits. But that's right in general. There are a lot of situations where you just can't have that saving.
And so what do we know about poverty because of this? I mean, in terms of, you know, we refer to people as, you know, living in poverty, but there's a tremendous amount of volatility in that. And that also, I would imagine, you know, this you did your study before Obamacare, for instance, was rolled out and the expansion of Medicaid that happened in certain areas. But, or Medicaid, I should say, but I would imagine that has impact too, right? I mean, that was almost what some of the things that were problematic about the way that was structured. You don't know if we're talking about 50% of the population, and you know, the exchange subsidies kick in at 133% of poverty. If you don't know 6 months out, like you can't possibly predict what your income's going to be, that's going to make that process that much more complicated.
Yeah, no, totally. Totally. I mean, another part about Obamacare, it's a huge help for lots of households, and the expansions, totally. However, you know, the households like the ones we got to meet, for the most part, chose high deductible plans, right? They just didn't have the slack to choose plans with better coverage. That meant that they were still vulnerable to huge out-of-pocket expenses. I mean, $500, $1,000, I think that's the average. And so they are ill-prepared for those ups and downs. They have insurance, but they're still very vulnerable to ups and downs. And what we saw was, you know, they'd avoid going to doctors. When they'd get prescriptions, they would take half the pills, if any. So I came to appreciate the power of Obamacare, but I also came to appreciate just how much further we have to go
right
to get a health system that works for these families. And this is a huge part of America.
Well, so what is there a story or two? Is there a family that sticks out for you that, you know, we're now 5 years out from 4 years out from these, you probably first looking at these diaries in their totality. Is there a family that still resonates with you?
There is one family that that we really start the book and end the book on. Their name is Becky and Jeremy, and they live in Ohio. It's Trump territory. I didn't ask them about their voting patterns, but they're probably Trump voters. They're an interesting family. They earn substantially above the poverty line, or enough to feel not poor. Jeremy's a truck mechanic. He fixes big rigs, but he's also subject to seasonal ups and downs. And one of the things we saw as we looked at their income was that even though on average they were safely above the poverty line, we actually saw 6 months of the year in which their income dipped below the poverty line. And in those instances, you know, Becky said they had to go on food stamps and they had to go to the state for health insurance just in order to make ends meet. And it was a weird situation for Becky. I mean, she's like caught between feeling not poor, because on average they weren't, but feeling poor at the same time because they're being sort of subject to these ups and downs in their income and with really very little help in dealing with it. And so Becky and Jeremy's situation, a really lovely young family trying to move forward in the world, but being sort of caught between an aim for mobility, but this fundamental instability that so many Americans feel. And Becky and Jeremy helped us see that the way we think about poverty as a binary, you know, either you're poor or you're not, just doesn't really fit. There are a lot of households that are poor some of the time, not poor other parts of the time, and we're not designing policies that help that kind of problem.
What are some of your top solutions that you would promote based upon what you saw?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. There are lots of different ways to think about this, and one of the big problems when we think about, you know, what's happening in the workplace is that risk is being shifted, as you said, from workers to, from bosses onto workers. And so one way, you know, of course, is collective action, ways that workers could, you know, retake some power and negotiate more strongly for better protections. I'm not going to hold my breath on that,
mm-hmm.
but that's clearly one thing which has changed in America, which is contributing to this. But there have been some attempts at regulation which I think could be helpful. So to the extent that variable hours is a story, there are attempts now to create legislation that guarantees workers at least predictable hours and, you know, notice well ahead of time when their hours are going to go up and down so that you don't find out that single day that you have to go home. So there's some hours scheduling legislation, which is happening in cities and states, which I think is really exciting and can help. There's also, you know, you were talking about, you know, credit cards and financial solutions. Really like to see stronger consumer protections. Part of the problem, as you were saying, is that, you know, households, when they're down, they don't have a lot of great solutions financially, and often they're preyed on by financial service providers. So keeping the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, maintaining it and strengthening it would really go far in helping protect these households. And the last thing isn't really a policy. It's just, you know, a set of ideas and products. We're starting to see a lot of, especially young people and startups, you know, designing new financial products and services for this population. Hmm. So simple, you know, smartphone-based apps that help people save, you know, that might kind of track someone's income, see it going up and down, and grab money when it's up and give it back to people when it's down, helping people save by automating it. So we're seeing a lot of innovation in different places. Some of it's policy-wise, some of it's product-wise. But there's a long way to go, and I think people are starting to pay attention to the problem, and that's the most important step.
Jonathan Murdoch, the book is The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. This was great.
Are we back here? Yep. Welcome back, everybody. Matt, do we have a Jimmy Reefer kick? No problem. Am I on mic? Okay, cool. Do we have a Jimmy Reefer kick song? I think we do. And if we do, we'll play that before...
It's not Friday.
Oh, right. It's not Friday. Tomorrow. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm having a moment of wish fulfillment here. Okay, everybody, the phone lines are on 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. We got a lot to get to, so let's just get right to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Write an iTunes review for the Majority Report. Subscribe. Use the Majority Report kickback. You know all the ways. See you on the fun half. Sad. She said, no, no.